Hey, welcome everyone to another episode of Acton Perspective Podcast. I'm your host, Hugh Simonet. It's the start of season two, and I'm excited about our lineup. In this season, we'll be discussing such things as the psychology of death, the concept of non-dualism, the purpose and benefits of meditation, the science of consciousness, along with a philosophical and scientific discussion on just who and what we are as human beings, the therapeutic value of psychedelics, and the recent discoveries related to the vast networks of how trees and plants communicate and care for each other, among many other topics. So if you like what you've seen here today, remember to subscribe. It's quick, easy, and totally free. Today, I'm very excited to be sitting across from Dr. Anthony Biglin. Now, Dr. Biglin is a senior scientist at the Oregon Research Institute that partners with others around the world to promote behavior change for sustainable health and well-being. Their emerging ideas right now include genetics, health economics, Alzheimer's disease, and opioid addiction. Tony is also co-director of Promised Neighborhood Research Consortium, which is a community-based network that works to improve well-being in high-poverty neighborhoods. He's also former president of the Society for Prevention Research, dedicated to advancing scientific investigation focused on the causes and prevention of social, physical, and mental health and academic problems. He was a member of the Institute of Medicine Committee on Prevention and of Oregon's Alcohol and Drug Policy Commission. His book, The Nurture Effect, How the Science of Human Behavior Could Improve Our Lives in Our World, and Rebooting Capitalism, How We Can Forge a Society That Works for Everyone, are a culmination of his life's work that lay the framework for a model of societal change. He has also created the nonprofit Values to Action to advance the reforms he calls for in his book, Rebooting Capitalism, where solution-focused action circles are created around societal issues where we apply the principles of contextual behavioral science. Now, if there's a problem you see in our society or in your community, an action circle is a way you can address it to achieve concrete results. So join valuestoaction.org and contribute just $47 to become a lifetime member. So without further ado, please help welcome Dr. Anthony Biglin.
I'm a behavior analyst, and I am interested in selection by consequences, but I've gone well beyond focus on the consequences of selecting the behavior of individuals, and I've basically applied an evolutionary analysis, is what it is, it's selection by consequences, to capitalism. And over the last 50 years, capitalism has become corrupted due to a very well-organized and well-funded effort to promote the view that essentially that if the individual is pursuing their own well-being, it will necessarily benefit everyone. Mm-hmm. That's the notion of the invisible hand. The metaphor that Adam Smith used in the 18th century has been pulled out by more recent economists. What he said was that the baker may set out to make a living by making a better bread or a cheaper bread, and in doing so, he benefits everyone. It's as though an invisible hand was, contributing the well-being of every person. Well, there's some truth to that. Market systems do have a tendency where people are simply competing in the market to make better products, that they often have innovations that are, valuable to people and that improve well-being. And if you don't believe that, then you better hand in your cell phone. Because that's a product of market forces. So I'm not inherently opposed to market forces. But what happened was that in 1970, there were about 1,900 bombings of businesses in the United States. If you're under 40, you probably have no idea how different this country is than it was 50 years ago. And it's different because starting in 1970, conservative forces were appropriately very concerned about their future and the well-being of capitalism because there was so much antipathy toward business. And so Lewis Powell, who would soon be appointed to the Supreme Court, wrote a memo to his neighbor, who was the chair of the Education Committee for the Chamber of Commerce. And that was a very insightful memo that businesses had tended to sort of pursue, each business pursuing its own interests, but the businesses needed to band together over an indefinite period of time, that's his phrase, to make the case for a business and for free market economics. And they did. And they spent hundreds of millions of dollars and basically changed society. One of the key things they did was that they went into universities and they realized that most of the universities were in the control of liberals and that if they directly attacked them, that wouldn't work. But what they did do was they started to fund programs that were, you know, they were funding scholars who could begin to speak for their interests. And they were very good at that, and particularly in economics. And so what grew was an increasing influence in academia for this free market notion. They trained a generation of economists and pundits and journalists who pushed this notion. And it was so successful that by the time that Bill Clinton was president, he could say the era of big government is over, that everybody agreed that regulation was problematic and that things work best if you let the markets, free markets deal with it, which is one of the justifications for starting to privatize prisons and privatize much of the military. The advocacy for free market economics basically changed the thinking of millions of Americans, and particularly policymakers and politicians, to believe that government was ineffective, that government was wasteful, and that almost any function in society would be better if it were left to entrepreneurs. So that was how we began to privatize prisons, under the argument that the motivation in a market system would be for people to become more efficient. Well, of course, you can increase your profits in running a prison if you simply cut back on many of the expenses and so on. So it's simply not the case that it is inherently true that if everybody is allowed to pursue their own well-being, that they will benefit everyone. And in fact, there's a whole area of economics called evenomics, evolutionary economics, that has been started by David Sloan Wilson, an evolutionary biologist, and others to make the case that, in fact, humans have evolved in circumstances where groups that cooperate do best. And so competition and the pursuit of one's own well-being is not necessarily in the interest of others. If you go to This View of Life, which is an online magazine, and you search my name, Biglan, I have documented the ways in which harmful marketing practices of six different industries have wreaked havoc on the well-being of Americans. Mm-hmm. Start with the tobacco industry. Tobacco industry kills about 450,000 people a year, and has been doing that. There are about 20 million people in the last 50 years who've died of cigarette smoking in this country alone. But in the context of the belief that regulation is bad, it was easy for the tobacco industry to push back against any efforts to regulate them. Other industries are the fossil fuel industry, the alcohol industry, the financial industry, the gun industry, the pharmaceutical industry, and the food industry, all of which have developed practices which were profitable to them. Selection by consequences. Oh, we made a pudding that can be made in 10 minutes instead of an hour, and women are working increasingly outside the home, and they're interested in something that'll be quick. And so hey, we did that. Well, they've done all kinds of food that they manufacture, that they have designed, which has immediate, taste sensations that people want and so on. But the young people are actually on a trajectory to live on average less. So I can go on and on about this, but the fundamental concept here is selection by consequences. And as long as we believe that regulation is necessarily bad, then we fight each of these industries one at a time. And so there are people working on tobacco control, people working on obesity, people working on the pharmaceutical industry. But we need to establish the principle, the public health principle, that if a practice of a corporation is harming a significant proportion of the population, then they should lose money in engaging in that practice. Not just pay fines like the pharmaceutical industry did. They paid fines, but they were still making money. It was just the cost of doing business. We have to make sure. So that's a principle. It's a public health principle that applies to all aspects of corporate activity, including what the social media do, as an alternative to the situation where the default assumption is that corp will benefit everyone. We got a long way to go. We got a lot of organizing to do, and that's why I created Values to Action, an organization that would actually pursue changes in society that are badly needed.
Yes. Yeah.
So, did I answer your question?
Yeah, it does. But then it leaves another question too that I'm sure a lot of other people have. Is, you know, we've known, well, at least I've known since the 1980s with Reaganomics, right? This trickle-down theory of economics doesn't work. Why aren't we just all waking up and saying, okay, now we're going to change the system? There's more of us than there are of them.
Let me say a couple of things about that. One is that, traditionally activists are people who, live on small amounts of money and spend all their time being activists, and God bless them, and they're fundamental. But there aren't very many people who are willing to say, I'm giving up my family, I'm giving up my job, I'm giving up my education so I can work for these important principles. We need to make it admirable to do that. But the other thing we need to do is make it a lot easier for people to put a small amount of their time into contributing to this.
Yeah.
So let me describe to you the action circles that Values to Action is creating that are enabling people to devote. They can join an action circle, and our proposition to them is that if you'd be willing to put an hour or two a week for about 8 weeks into a specific problem, we will produce a product that's a building block for the next steps in this, and that we can create a movement. And most of our work so far has been on action circles designing what local action circles could do to make a difference. So one of my favorite examples is reading instruction. We have known for 50 years how to effectively teach children to read. And yet the disparities between minority children and just poor children and other kids has not changed in the country in 50 years. And so, in fact, I did research with Barbara Gunn, instruction for teaching kids to read, and they were more competent readers than the kids who didn't get that program. We just replicated what other people had shown. But so we created an action circle to design what could be done in a local community to, first of all, help the community understand how important reading success is, excuse me, and then to provide the community with ways of improving outcomes. We'll help teachers adopt more effective instructional practices, for sure. We could help families in the neighborhoods increase the degree to which kids have pre-reading skills by encouraging reading to them, by encouraging talking to them, and things of that sort. But we can also provide assistance to parents or to volunteers to provide supplemental instruction to kids on reading, the kind of thing that we did in our research that has been shown to work. And so we're prepared to help communities do that and to significantly improve the proportion of kids who can read effectively. That's just one example. We have other action circles, especially if you're a behavior analyst, would be interested in increasing the availability of behavior analytics services for children and adults with developmental disabilities in healthcare settings, because there's a real problem there. You may have a child with autism who becomes uncontrollable with the prospect of having a needle or having blood drawn or you know, doing a variety of things. And most medical practitioners don't have experience with how to deal with that. And so very often, a child with autism doesn't get the treatment that they need. They can't do the tests. They can't provide the treatment. Behavior analysts know how to help them. In fact, we identified one of the women who joined our action circle is the first behavior analyst hired by Boston Children's Hospital. And she just has story after story of how, you know, with a simple, you know, intervention that she did, she helped a kid get the treatment they needed, get the diagnosis they needed. So we wrote a guide to how healthcare settings can get behavior analysts and why they should have behavior analysts. And we have a summary of all of the different ways that behavior analysts can make a difference. We're about to start promoting that to people who run clinics who may not be behavior analysts and to behavior analysts who are trying to influence clinics. So you can see that that could be a movement nationwide, as could the reading effort, right? So there's the two. Then there's climate change. We analyze the degree to which there's funding for research on reducing greenhouse gas emissions. And we discovered that there's virtually no federal funding for research on how you could reduce greenhouse gas emissions. And so we've published some papers on that, and we have actually been doing advocacy to get lawmakers to understand that this is a problem, and we're still doing a number of things on that in that sphere. Let's see. So we've got a number of others that are going, but name a problem, and I'll tell you how an action circle.
Okay. Childhood poverty.
Childhood poverty. Well, the first thing is that there is a national report that summarizes programs and policies that would reduce child poverty. Now, I will say that what the Biden administration is doing has already reduced poverty, though the policies that they've adopted are going to expire in a couple of years. I've forgotten exactly when. So would it be helpful if every policymaker knew what those effective policies are? So, you know, the National Academy of Medicine does this report, competent economists summarizing the evidence for a package of things that could be helpful, some of which could be done at the local level, some of which could be done at the state level, some of which would require federal law. To join Values to Action for only $47, again, to advocate for the things that are needed. Easily done. We could do in 8 weeks, you could have a good, clean document that you could then market to people in local communities to encourage them to adopt these things. By the way, the Action Circle would also identify all the organizations that are working against child poverty and help them, you know, make the case and form a coalition with them. We need a movement. I recommend to any of our listeners that they read Robert Putnam's new book, Upswing, which is the story of the social movement in the first half of the 20th century that increasingly got people to work together across, you know, traditional boundaries. The Depression was one of the factors that, you know, influenced people to do that. The Second World War was at one where everybody came together to do something together. And so that kind of thing caused an upswing in all kinds of measures of the degree to which people were getting along, right? That began to erode. And in the 1970s, about the time that, there was disruption in the 1960s, and then Lewis Powell wrote his memo, And it encouraged the view that everybody should pursue their own well-being and it'll be just fine. If you're making a lot of money, you must be doing good. And so division increased. Do we have division? We have unprecedented division in this country. Social media have a lot to do with that. Chapter, I think, 8 in my book is on social media and how social media applied division. And they're continuing to do it. One of the things we're doing is we're actually working with the community where we're trying to reverse that trend. It's a community that has a lot of division. And what we're trying to do is use principles of kernel, behavioral influence kernels, to increase the degree to which people are working together and positively reaching out to people on the other side, so-called other side. There's a lot that can be done there. So child poverty. And by the way, some of the techniques of listening to other people and communicating with other people in persuasive ways, not you're wrong, yeah, but listening to them and so on. That's in, I think, chapter 3 of Rebooting Capitalism. This is a book that tells you where these problems came from and what we can do about them. Mm-hmm. And so I urge people to read Rebooting Capitalism and join the movement. We created Values to Action as one entity trying to promote this movement. But, you know, there's a lot to be done. But, you know, I was part of a, you know, sort of liberal movement in the 1960s. And it was a great time. It was like, we're going to make a difference. You know, we're, you know, so, you know, there's a lot of reason to join this just because it's fun and you'll feel like you're doing something. There's a problem, though. And that is, we've got another one I haven't mentioned. We are, 73% of Americans are either dissatisfied or very dissatisfied with corporations, okay? So those corporations are giving lots of money to what's come to be called the Sedition Caucus. I mean by that, the 10 senators and the 137 congresspeople who voted to overturn the election of Biden. That's the Sedition Caucus, and they're continuing to do it, and they're working very hard and with great success so far to change the voting regulations in their favor and to suppress the votes of people that aren't going to vote for them. So the corporations are funding these people. Since January 6th, $10 million has gone to the members of the Sedition Caucus from major corporations in this country. If you go to CREW, C-R-E-W's website, you'll find the data on that. And so what we're trying to do is get thousands of people to reach out to these corporations, to the CEOs, to the members of the board, to the heads of the unions of these corporations, and say, you've got to stop this. You are supporting sedition. And we believe that employees and stockholders and customers could make a difference if we can, you know, get a movement going on this. And so that's what we're trying to do. And that's an action circle. It's designing that.
Excellent. Yeah, it seems like, you know, we always feel like common sense will prevail, right? And there's a lot on our side who would assume, naturally assume, well, in the end, common sense will reign, and so I don't really have to do anything. But there is an actual force, right? A very strong mitigating force that,
well,
we're opposing for our side.
So there's a lot of different ways to think about this, but with me, there was a famous physician who, worked his entire life trying to improve health in Africa. Steve Hayes likes to point out that we revere this man because of what he did, because he lived his values. And if you look at the health of people in Africa, you could say, well, you know, it isn't a whole lot better than it was. We revere him for what he tried to do. Now, there's another reason, I think, why people may hesitate to get active. And that is that it's a terrible time to speak up, because when you speak up, you may be attacked. And so that's something we have to overcome. And I think one of the ways that we can overcome it is by having people working to and feeling the love of other people who are, you know, similarly trying to do things. That's why we need a movement. That's why we need people working in action circles. And so we've got to help people get over that hump. The Zuckerberg principle that's enraging, that is threatening, that is troubling, that more people will pay attention to it. In the latest Atlantic, about the impact of Instagram on depression among adolescent girls. And he shows that, you know, they start being on Instagram and then there's all kinds of comparisons, am I pretty, and stuff like that. And he shows that depression soared among that segment of the population when Instagram came into being.
Yeah, I have a 15-year-old daughter who, it's awful, so I see the effects daily.
Well, you might read the hype article and show it to her. It would be a good idea. So there's a challenge here, but the Zuckerberg principle is working for us with respect to corporations, because the message we have about corporations is they're doing terrible things and they're threatening democracy and you should care about it. So it might get people going, but we need more people actively involved, and we need them to like any post they see that are consistent with this, to share it, to expand their social network, and to do that in a way that they're in a safe social environment in doing it. And that's what we're working on. We're just doing this. So I brought up the guy in Africa. Because one of the things that acceptance and commitment therapy, Steve Hayes is, you know, created, and others, is that it helps people to make their lives about living their values, even in the face of, you know, things not going well.
Yeah.
That what can be reinforcing for you is, I live my values today. And, you know, and that's pretty much where I'm at. I'm not an optimist particularly about this stuff.
Yeah.
I do think that if we can get a significant movement, we can make a difference. It has happened before. It had happened in the first half of the 20th century, but it needs all different kinds of people working together. But at this point, I think that the reinforcer for you, if you join this movement, is knowing that you're doing important things with other people who join you and you're caring for you. And we could make some difference. We could have more kids reading. We could have more kids getting good treatment in healthcare clinics. We could improve the health and well-being of the population. So that's my promise.
Yeah. And, you know, it brings me to my next question, because you say that it all pivots in the nurture effect here. Excellent book.
Yes. Great book.
That it pivots around nurturance and psychological flexibility. If you want to talk a little bit more about what the importance is of nurturance and psychological flexibility in all this.
Well, I nurturance is sort of the opposite of coercion. There's a whole long line of research over the last 50 years, which was started by Jerry Patterson. He was one of the first people to take behavioral principles and apply them to the behavior of kids. One of the first studies they did was, there was a kid in a classroom who had these were movable desks, and this kid would be moving his desk all over the place. So they put they said reinforcement makes a difference. Nobody actually proved it with human beings, right? So they put a light on his desk that went off whenever he were, you know, reinforcement for that. And sure enough, he stopped moving around. And then he started working with parents and helping parents to use these kinds of principles with their kids. And what developed was, a line of research that, you know, to this day is, you know, has a very effective family interventions. There are probably four or five different evidence-based family interventions that grew out of the work that Jerry did. And what he discovered was that families with aggressive kids we're significantly more likely to be engaging in coercive behavior. Well, what do I mean by coercive behavior? I mean the use of aversive. So, for example, mom says to Johnny, Johnny says, I don't want to go to bed. And mom backs off. But what just happened? Well, Johnny got reinforced for his aversive behavior because he ain't going to bed. And mom got reinforced for backing off because he's not whining and complaining anymore. And what Jerry found was that there was a tendency in families with aggressive kids for people to engage in a little aggressive behavior and a little aggressive behavior and a little aggressive and keep going. And then somebody would explode and that would end the episode, right? All other people, and this is especially true of boys, they were more likely to be aversive to peers. They were more likely to be uncooperative to teachers, and they were more likely to fail in school. And so by the time they got to early adolescence, many of these kids were socially rejected and not doing well in school and didn't like school and so on. But they met other kids who had a similar history, and it was magic. Suddenly they had a friend who would talk to them about all the deviant stuff that they were, you know, and so it was wonderful. And in fact, Tom DeShawn did a study where he had kids who were at risk when they were about 12 or 13, bring a friend into the lab and had them just talk about things that, you know, kids, these were all boys, boys would be interested in. And so what they found was that if there was deviant talk followed by laughter, deviant talk, laughter, deviant talk, laughter, predict the socialization of deviant behavior. Capaldi and Tom DeShawn had those same kids come in with bring a friend, guy. And if there was demeaning talk about women, laughter, demeaning talk about women, laughter, that contingency predicted violence toward women a couple years later, right?
Yeah.
The socialization of men. We actually published a paper on that. And in fact, if your audience email, that's tony@bigland.org, mm-hmm. tony@ORI stands for Oregon Research Institute.org. If you email me at either one of those, I will send you a paper that we wrote on socialization of men. If you go to the values to action .org website, you'll also find that paper and other papers there. But I think where we started with this is nurturance versus coercion. And so nurturance is a matter of helping people replace coercive ways of interacting with more nurturing ones, listening, touching, you know, much higher rates of positive reinforcement. But I'm not talking about M&Ms and stickers. I'm talking about, you know, listening and caring and touching and holding and just cooperating with and playing with and so on. So that's one of the principles of nurturing environments is reduce coercion. Another is increase positive reinforcement, but also reduce biologically toxic conditions as well. Things like airborne lead or high levels of omega-6 in the diet are factors that contribute to problematic development. And then there's also reducing opportunities and influences for problem behavior. Opportunities like kids home alone without adult supervision, which is a time when kids experiment with problem behavior, especially if they have a friend over. And there's also influences on problem behavior, like the marketing of cigarettes, the marketing of guns, the marketing of unhealthful food, the marketing of alcohol. And so those influences need to be controlled. And there's good evidence that when you reduce those influences, those problem behaviors are less likely to occur. And the last but not least is psychological flexibility. We need to promote the willingness of people to have whatever thoughts and feelings they have, but to be clear about their values and to work consistent with those values, even in the context of troubling thoughts, I couldn't succeed, and so on. And so those are the elements of nurturing environments. And I believe that in promoting that kind of nurturance in every environment is fundamental to creating the kind of society we want. And it's happening. The PACS Good Behavior Game creates nurturing environments in elementary schools, and it's in more than 40,000 classrooms. There are family interventions that are helping families to do that. So we're making progress.
Yeah.
It's a race, you know?
I can personally tell you about the decades of social reinforcement or social conditioning, right? That it's if your child does not do what they're supposed to do, it is a matter of force. You are the parent. You control the situation. So you are, you know, it seems everybody was socially conditioned where I came from, where it was force that made the difference. And it's this huge turnaround that's counterproductive. This side of nurturance and positive reinforcement seems to be counterintuitive to getting things done, but is the most productive way of getting things done in the long run.
Right.
Yes. Yeah.
You'll live a longer life.
Oh yeah. Yeah. All right. And it's not, you know, it's like steering a cruise ship. It's not an overnight process. It's a daily work.
Yeah.
When people contact values to action, what can they expect? Can they, what is the versatility and what do they look for?
Well, probably get an email from me thanking them for joining, but we've got about 170 people who joined already. And then we ask them when they join, you know, what kinds of things are you interested in working on? Mm-hmm. And we're creating action circles to do those things. Mm-hmm. So far, Values to Action has been pretty much supported from retirement funds that I take out of my retirement, you know, to support it. But we're starting to get donations, and we're also getting some contracts to do this kind of thing.
Yeah.
The question is, you join a community of people who have similar values and similar knowledge. Mm-hmm. One of the things that I'm actually giving a talk later today to a set of behavior analysts who, my experience since I published the Nurture Effect, and I've met literally hundreds of behavior analysts, is that they're frustrated that science that they were taught is relevant to every aspect of human behavior, mm-hmm. is mostly being applied in organizations and with people with developmental disabilities. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of my work in principles, broadly conceived, including you know, the work of on contextual behavioral science and relational frame theory and psychological flexibility and so on, that is a science that is up to the task of dealing with all of the problems of society. And so you get to join a group of people who are increasing their repertoires and increasing the impact of behavior analysis on the world.
Great. And can a person create their own value circle, or do they have to join from the existing value circles?
Well, we're pretty open. Yeah. So there's one I didn't mention about maybe a year ago. Got an email from a woman named Katie Terry, and she had just finished a master's degree in behavior analysis, and she was going to join starting graduate school in clinical psychology in a couple months, but she had. So we said, okay, let's create an. I created an action circle, and we got about 8 or 10 people to work on it. And what we did was we first summarized the evidence on. I mean, you know, you can sit at home with Google, and you can do so much. Mm-hmm. So the first thing we did was we documented the degree to which the current system is typically quite punitive. And that there are huge disparities in the degree to which minority group kids are on a school to prison pipeline and so on. So, and then we summarized the evidence from Mark Lipsey's work that showed what kinds of interventions with kids who have been adjudicated delinquent are more likely to be effective and successful. And what you find is that they're not the punitive things. It's not scared straight. It's cognitive behavior therapy and so on. So that's good, but that's not nearly enough, because what you can also do is prevent offending in the first place. And the way you do that is you back up and you make sure that a child's social environment, both in their schools and in their family, is supporting the kind of pro-social behavior development that they need and is preventing the development of deviant peer groups. If there are fewer kids who are, you know, not liked by their peers and so on, there are fewer deviant peer groups going to be formed. And in fact, I have a colleague, Mark Van Rysen, who has shown that a program called Cooperative Learning, which is an approach to teaching, is very successful in reducing kids' involvement in problem behavior. And the way it works is you just create small teams of, you know, like four people who work together on a specific learning task. And by cooperating, they get to know each other and like each other, and they cross the usual boundaries of boys versus girls, or, you know, black versus white, or whatever divisions, you know, the snobby kids, the social kids, the jocks, and so on. They're all working together and they're learning to cooperate. And this is a program that's been shown over 40 years to improve the academic success of kids and to reduce prejudice and increase and prevent the substance use and so on. So you can search Mark Van Rysen and peer learning, or you can just email me at tony@ori.org and I'll introduce you to Mark. He's doing some wonderful work on that.
Okay. All right. You know, just a more of a foundational question, this art of relating to another human being. Right. So now you're talking about relating to a whole group of individuals. And is it more of an art form than a science, or science than art?
I'm sort of reluctant to answer that because first of all, because I don't know the answer. It puts a juxtaposition between yeah. I'm a scientist and you're only an artist, or, you know, you scientists, you know. How can I say this? Let's see. It starts with David's analysis of pro-sociality. Mm-hmm. And the analysis of that to the effect that human groups have flourished because they cooperated, because they were pro-social, because they were good at suppressing the selfish behavior of members of the group. And so cooperative groups tend to outcompete non-cooperative groups. But how and why would they do that? Well, now, if you mean by art, you know, things like music, or, you know, paintings, or, you know, anything of that sort, that, you know, why do those things evolve? Because they have facilitated people working together. So, you know, it's sort of a false distinction. I mean, the science has shown that when people work together well, groups do better. But by the way, you know, that includes, you know, the Germans marching into Norway. You know, I mean, those people were very cooperative, you know, but they don't necessarily benefit right. other groups and so on. But are all of the things that happen in a culture affect the, you know, the outcomes for that culture? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, art could be in the interests of pro-sociality. It could be in the interests of the group. It could be in the interests of the larger groups. I mean, what David is trying to do is show that you can have pro-sociality within the group, but you can also have groups that are, you know, at a higher level are cooperating together. What's the social movement I'm talking about? You know, requires not just values to action, but all these other organizations getting along and working together. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah. You know what I was, years ago, I read Walden 2, right? Well, one of my favorite quotes out of Skinner and how he fictionalized account of a utopia. But it seemed like when I was finished the book, I said, man, it seems like it's really missing something. It's very mechanized.
Right.
So he thought of every little, you know, like he's taking apart a car and then he's putting it back together to make a better car. And say, well, he's missing an element of humanism. And I don't know if that was that's a correct characterization of that, but I got the sense that it was missing an element of humanism that seems to be beyond the science. So where the science seems to be cold, where the humanistic side seems to be where the connection is. Is that a right characterization?
A lot of the pushback against Skinner. Okay. Well, a lot of the pushback against Skinner was that, you know, he didn't believe in feelings and so on. Mm. And there was some truth to that. And I think that many people were attracted to behaviorism because it didn't deal with all that touchy-feely stuff, right? But touchy-feely stuff has come roaring back in as acceptance and commitment therapy has come not only to have a big impact among behavior analysts, but in clinical psychology. I think it's, what is science? Science is a set of methods for, finding out things, and you can do it for a variety of reasons. The version of science that that Steve has advocated and I've been involved in is a functional contextualism, where the goal of the science is to predict and influence a particular outcome. That could be for any kind of outcome. But I think it's also the case that what research on acceptance and commitment therapy has shown is that people function better when they are in environments that are loving and caring, and when they are themselves are loving and caring. And so there's a chapter that Steve and I wrote in the Handbook of Contextual Behavioral Science on this. Mm-hmm. And it talks about this issue, that there's a kind of love that has been called, I think, agape, which is a, is distinct from romantic love or, sexual love. It's a choice to be loving, even in the context of feelings like I'm angry with you and so on.
Yeah.
And I actually think that's the way I think about love, that I realize, because, people fall in love for a variety of reasons, and sex, often has a lot to do with it, and romance and so on. But, then the first time that she did this thing I didn't really like, then I complained. Coercion is big time in marital discord. It's a coercive process, right? Mm-hmm. But you can choose to love a person even in the context of having feelings, And the example I give in the nurture effect is that we had this cat with diabetes. And so we had to give her a warning, and I forgot. Mm-hmm. And I let Georgia know that I'd forgotten. So she comes to me. And we would all put out the food. And when, Meepos is eating the food, you give the injection, right? So she comes to me, and we did it upstairs and up here. So she hands it to me. She has prepared the syringe. She's prepared the food. And she's angry. And I can do what we've done many times in our relationship. I'll sit on the other end of the sofa, and I won't talk to her. And we'll get into bed, and I won't talk to her. And, or I can just let it go, and I can sit and cuddle with her, and it's a choice.
It is a choice.
Well, and you can have those feelings even as you're acting consistent with your values.
Well, last question. So I wanted to ask you, I know we're out of time, but I wanted to ask you how you then create continuing to create that distance between your thoughts, feelings, and how do you practice?
I really don't think about it as distancing. Uh-huh. I think that may be why, although, as soon as they said acceptance and commitment therapy, there were issues with acceptance as well. But if you try to distance yourself from your feelings in the sense that there's a sense in which that's an avoidance of feelings. And so I just, you know, I'm more inclined to just take them with me. I can't remember. Oh, I had a terrible day playing basketball, just awful. Just, and it was one of a series of them, right? And I just felt sorry for myself. And I told my wife, I'm feeling sorry for myself today. And so I, you know, there's the saying among the ACT people that the rules about feelings are, if you don't want the feeling, that's exactly what you're going to have. If you don't want to be anxious, you're going to be anxious. Why? Because you're focused on not having, you know, and so I the notion of distancing, you're trying to distance from this. You're in the presence of the feeling, right? You can't, you know, so you just have to accept whatever's there in the sense that you hold it lightly. And you say, you know, and I don't like feeling like this. And I feel that, you know. So I've stopped wrestling with my feelings. Yeah. And that's a lot what happens in acceptance and commitment therapy, that people are helped actually to open themselves to the feelings that they have. And very often that can be a very powerful experience where, you know, I hated my dad and he was just terrible and so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. And you've built your life around hating him. Mm-hmm. And it hasn't worked for you. It's, you know, you've been angry. And actually to just accept that you're of these feelings may, you know, there may be an enormous upswelling of feeling, but also an ability to have that feeling. And very often I've seen that people actually are able to go back and make peace with their parents, even, you know. And one of the things that Steve has sometimes said to people is, okay, so you talked about how your parents treated you in a way that caused you to have these problems with depression and anger and so on, right? So if you woke up tomorrow morning and you didn't feel any of that anymore, who would go free? Your parents would go free. Yeah. You would have to let them go. Mm-hmm. Is it possible that part of what's going on here is that you are holding them responsible and proving that you're right, that they've ruined your life by having your life ruined? And maybe you can just kind of let go of that and move forward with what's important to you.
Yeah. Beautiful. Yeah, I wanted to leave on that because it's important for when we come with this with the right frame of mind. We're not going to solve the world's problems overnight, but the idea is to move forward according toward our values, independent of how we think and feel sometimes.
Right.
You know? Yeah, thank you so much, Tony. And okay. Good luck today, and we'll be talking soon.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. All right, bye-bye.
Spit on the ground, hold your breath, try to scare yourself to death. Bury your bones under the dirt and tear your heart and rip your shirt and stomp your feet in disgust. Curse the gray skies if you must, but you'll find when you are done, blue skies for everyone. The race before you start, drop your drawers and roll around, burn your house right to the ground, go to sleep, hit your head, scream until your face is red, but you'll find when you are done, blue skies for everyone, blue skies, setting sun, cherry pie.